This is Hear Me Out. I'm Celeste Headley. There's a lot to dislike and distrust about the American healthcare system. We know about disparities in care quality, in the ability to access care, and in education about health. The anti-vax or vaccine skeptical movement is growing faster than ever in the modern history of vaccines, and a lot of us have a hard time dredging up any sympathy for those people. But what if they're responding to the frustrations and fears that we all have about medical care?
For all of us, it's important to speak from a place of empathy and try to understand if it's not just the characterizations that we see in the news, or if it's not just the worst case scenario that we think of when we think of people asserting certain viewpoints.
Johanna Richland of the University of Maine joins Hear Me Out in just a moment. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome back to Hear Me Out. I'm Celeste Headley. More Americans now oppose vaccine requirements for school children. Not a majority, but more. Data from the Pew Center last year found that between October 2019 to March of 2023, the number of parents who think vaccines should be optional went up. To be clear, the increase was modest, going from 16% to 28% of all Americans surveyed. And again, the vast majority of Americans believe vaccines should be mandatory in public schools. Still, the results look different when sorted for political party. In recent years, the percentage of self-described conservatives who oppose vaccine requirements more than doubled. The ratio of conservatives for and against vaccine requirements is now almost 1-to-1. And look, this is a show about debating, but there is no debate that vaccines work. The ones we require children to have before attending public schools are safe and effective at keeping individuals and the collective safe. More than 90% of doctors believe adults and children should receive all recommended vaccines, and it's hard to get that kind of consensus in science on anything. So vaccine skepticism can be hard to understand and really easy to vilify. Our guest today wants us to rethink that condemnation because she's spoken to vaccine skeptical mothers and found it's not ignorance or ideology fueling the skepticism all the time. It's sometimes real issues with the way we run our healthcare system. Johanna Richland is an anthropologist at the University of Maine. Hi there.
Hi.
So for those who don't know you, tell us who you are and what you do.
So I am an assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Maine, where I teach classes on cultural anthropology in the classroom. And I'm also a writer who publishes research in academic channels and writes popular pieces on my research, most recently on vaccine skepticism among mothers. My broader interests are kind of on how belief and feeling circulate in U.S. society. And so before looking at vaccine skepticism, I was really interested in religious belief and evangelical Christianity among migrants recently moving to the United States.
So your point of view that you're bringing to us is that it may be easy to criticize and insult people who don't vaccinate their kids, but that is not always deserved, right? The general view by the majority of Americans who see no problem with the vaccine is that if you oppose vaccines, it's either, as you said, for political reasons or because you don't get it, don't understand. Why is that wrong?
Well, I think it's an oversimplification. I mean, I think that there, first of all, I want to just preface what I'm going to say by noting that my research is ongoing, that I think there are many different ways people arrive at vaccine skepticism, and my research is really highlighting one avenue that I don't think gets very much attention, so I think it helps to complicate and bring nuance to the conversation. I also think it's important to note that it's very possible for people to have adverse interactions and encounters with the medical system and not end up refusing or rejecting vaccines. So I think there's more kind of nuance there as well. But for many of the people that I spoke to, it was not random that they arrived at a position of feeling like the medical system writ large was untrustworthy, and that their personal experiences from childhood through childbirth through, you know, reproductive years in general had been fairly traumatizing for many women, and that experience, those day-to-day repeated experiences and encounters, stripped them of trust for not only their individual doctors or nurses or providers, where they experienced or perceived harm, but of an entire system writ large. And that's really where I think the problem lies, is that we know, and as my article goes into and other research goes into, we know that medical errors and medical harm, especially for women and underrepresented minorities, remains very high, staggeringly so, in the United States. And that happens disproportionately for people of color and for non-binary folks. And all of that means that people are sustaining these kinds of experiences that are either demeaning or diminishing, or, you know, more serious, they're being misdiagnosed or they're not being diagnosed correctly. And that leads people to therefore question the kind of care that they're getting, and then to extend that questioning to the public health care system more generally. And so I think it's important to kind of look at our own systems and structures, and this is what kind of cultural anthropology can help us do. And instead of kind of place the blame on individuals and see vaccine skepticism as individual pathology or even political pathology, that we can see how our own systems actually generate a predisposition towards distrust that actually exists in lived experience. And that maybe if we kind of validate that experience or address that, that people would be more willing potentially to take on something that they feel otherwise concerned about, that it wouldn't be so easy to dismiss.
Okay, so let me jump in here, because let me start with the question about BIPOC people, which a lot of people still have in their minds this idea that vaccine uptake is lower among African Americans and Hispanic or Latino Americans, which was true at the very beginning of the pandemic, but is not true anymore. And in fact, the people who are most likely to refuse vaccines, statistically speaking, are white Americans, especially those who are conservative. That to me flies in the face of this idea that it's not related to politics, because we're talking about a group of people. When you talk about those who in large numbers oppose vaccines, they're mostly conservatives. The conservative is so much more likely to resist and oppose vaccine mandates than any other group.
Yeah, I that's not untrue at all. And I just want to be clear here that my research is not primarily about necessarily the COVID-19 vaccine, but rather this kind of longer simmering history of vaccine skepticism within the United States. And so there are lots of different demographics, and there's lots of different kind of populations. And certainly the politicization of the question has become extreme in the last, you know, since the pandemic, through Trumpism, through the rise of the medical freedom movement and kind of political organizing on the right to make medical freedom and the idea of parental choice and medical autonomy to be very, very foundational, central, key issues in their political platforms. So I certainly agree with all of that. And that's not really what my research is on. My research is really looking at how mothers in particular in this piece that I'm writing about are talking about their own arrival at vaccine skepticism. And this is at the beginning. The research was done in 2020, 2021. So the kind of medical freedom movement was just gaining traction. And now in 2024 has kind of exploded. So there's this whole other thing going on that is not really where my research began. And there are a lot of people who are studying the kind of more political piece of it. But what I'm trying to look at is what provides an inroad for people to begin doubting, right? And so maybe it is the political piece that is kind of what people are seeing most clearly right now. And that's clearly very consequential and yes, very much falls along the line of the kind of conservative and liberal divide. But I'm kind of interested again in my interest of the circulation of feeling, the circulation of belief is why do these stances become believable for so many people when we do have so much evidence to the contrary regarding vaccines and why they're important and how they do protect children and elderly and all of us. So if we know all of that, why does it become so believable? Why is it so easy for politicians to kind of appropriate language of vaccine skepticism and prey on people's feelings of distrust? Where do these broader feelings of distrust come from? And so I think there's lots of places on the political side of things where we can look at, you know, we can look at conservative Christianity, we can look at rural populations and the kind of, you know, disillusionment and the loss of jobs and kind of grievance in those areas in the United States that are kind of affiliated with far-right extremism and kind of rural loss in many places. But my research to this point, at least, has really been looking at how can we think about our systems and the failures in healthcare themselves for how they at least make people more likely to believe that that vaccines are not protecting them and that medical care and public healthcare systems are not intent on providing for their health rather than making their own wealth. Why is that so easy for people to believe? And so I think the gender dimension here is really important in my research, and that for women in particular, there's a lot of data about birth trauma, obstetric harm, adverse outcomes for women and for babies at a much higher rate than peer nations here in the United States. And that all of that data means that, you know, people aren't just crazy. The women that I'm talking to are not just crazy, that their feelings of not being taken care of or not really trusting their medical providers, you know, is unreasonable, but rather that those feelings and those experiences would lead to an after effect and a spillover that then can be potentially co-opted by the political sphere, to me makes some sense.
So we have to take a break, but there is a lot still more to talk about. So stay with us. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is Hear Me Out from Slate, and we'll be back. With what seems like an endless amount of information right at our fingertips, we tend to forget that wondering about things is really part of the journey to finding answers we're looking for. So when it comes to the hot topics of Israel, Judaism, and Zionism, there is so much more to wonder about right now, and it's hard to know where to turn in the flood of information. Enter the latest weekly podcast from Unpacked, Wondering Jews with Michal and Noam. Join hosts and educator extraordinaires Michal Bitten and Noam Weissman as they tackle these topics and the uncomfortable questions that surround them, with the goal of working towards the answers together with their listeners. No matter where you're from, if you've ever wondered about anything, this is the podcast for you. So check it out. Subscribe to Wondering Jews with Michal and Noam on your favorite podcast app today. Wondering Jews is brought to you by Unpacked, a division of Open Door Media.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
We're back. This is Hear Me Out, a podcast from Slate. I'm Celeste Headlee, and today we're talking about parents, especially women who hesitate to get vaccines, not just for themselves, but especially for their children. And our guest says we should not be so quick to call them names. Whereas for the majority of society who sees the importance of vaccines, it can be really easy to get angry at the hesitant almost immediately. So, Johanna, I want to ask about that, especially for those I can absolutely imagine. I've read a number of pieces from people in the disabled community saying this is not okay. Regardless of what somebody's motivations are for avoiding vaccines, you're putting a lot of people at risk. And there are a number of studies, including some that predate COVID, showing that vaccine hesitancy leads to absolutely preventable deaths. So, I mean, it's natural for people to get angry, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think that, I mean, a large reason why it's important to study vaccine non-vaccination practices, whether it's selective vaccination or vaccine refusal outright, or, you know, any form of kind of beliefs that are not confident, I think are important to study exactly because they are important. So if we're trying to improve uptake and we're trying to improve utilization, and we don't want vaccines to become a flashpoint that enters politicization and the culture wars, then shouldn't we understand why it is that people are refusing and rejecting or feeling suspicious and take that seriously? And so that's part of what motivates my research, is to try to understand rather than dismiss, an entire swath of the population as being crazy and hysterical, is to try to understand from the ground how it is that these belief systems and these approaches and orientations, again, become reasonable and make sense for the people who are asserting them. And I think a couple of things are going on. The first I kind of outlined in terms of the real ways that our healthcare system fails large populations and so makes people more distrusting. And again, that's not just mothers, but there are other populations where vaccine skepticism tends to circulate. The second thing that I think is important is that because of this distrust, there's kind of a gap and a void that is then filled by alternative messaging. And that is the kinds of materials and disinformation that we've seen absolutely kind of exponentially grow in the last several years. There was just an article I saw on healthcare misinformation on the New York Times front page today, that these materials become taken up and then circulate so quickly and become the talking points of people who no longer trust the FDA or the CDC precisely because they have reasons in their own lived experience to distrust. They've lost the trust of physicians or of nurses or of their family clinics, or they've heard stories of friends and families who've lost trust. And therefore, it becomes easier for those folks to then reach for these alternative framings that not only seem to make sense to them and give kind of credence to what they believe, but to validate their concerns in a way that's not dismissive. And so I think that that's part of the issue that we're seeing.
Yeah, except, Johanna, I don't think we can get away from the fact that even those who are vulnerable to vaccine hesitancy, we cannot separate this from people who are being manipulated by political actors and by misinformation. And the reason I say that is because, to my mind, Black Americans have more reason to distrust the healthcare system in the United States than pretty much any other group. There's no other group of Americans who've been unethically and illegally tested on and abused by healthcare providers than Black Americans. And yet, even though Black Protestants have a high rate of skepticism about, say, the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, the percentage who think that they are children shouldn't be required to get it for school is by orders of magnitude lower than white evangelicals and other conservatives. I mean, we're talking about a group of people. You have this combination of partisanship, hyper-partisanship, and then this politically driven identity of parental rights. Parental rights trumping everything. And then you combine that with a conservative tendency in recent years to denigrate authority, to denigrate or lessen any respect in experts and expert opinions. And that creates, I'm sorry to use the cliche, but this sort of perfect storm of people who are not going to get vaccines. I mean, I get what you're saying, that these are people who have a reason to trust the healthcare system. But quite frankly, every single American has a reason to distrust the healthcare
exactly.
system.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's an excellent point, and that's part of the research too, which is why is it that certain populations and certain demographics, even if, as you say, they have personal experiences, collective histories, ongoing kind of exposures and traumas to medical harm, why is it that there's this kind of divide? Why is it that some people end up then writing off the entire system, including public health care and, you know, mandatory or recommended vaccines?
And the safety of the people
around
them.
Yes, and other people don't. And so that's why, again, I think it's important to remember that we don't know all of these answers, but I think that they are important questions to ask, and not to think that all of these different pieces of the puzzle are unrelated. Just to your point about how people are being manipulated by disinformation, I think that this is a really important aspect, that the manipulation and the kind of disinformation that gets circulated, one of the reasons that people, you know, are compelled by it and find it attractive is because for some people, not for everybody, but for some people, it seems to answer questions that they otherwise, you know, haven't had answered, or it validates things that they already have concerns about. And so it is a perfect storm, I think, that there is a kind of increasing anxiety, increasing distrust, increasing loss of feeling settled and oriented in the contemporary U.S. landscape, and reaching for many different ways of trying to answer, which way is up. And for people that don't have trusted institutions, you know, then and look to the kind of refusal and the rejection of authority, then absolutely this is one piece of that as well. And we know that that's become increasingly so as the kind of Republican Party and the right have made kind of vaccine refusal and rejection of mandatory vaccines as key kind of components of their platform.
So another argument I would have is that, I mean, we know, science knows, that the least accurate information you can get about human beings is self-reports. And I know that when it comes to things that are connected to, especially things that are connected to politics, especially when they involve so-called hot button topics like gender and disability and race, people will give motivations for the reason why they're doing things, whether it's why they voted for a certain person, why they took a particular stance, that are not the truth. And the other thing I'll say is that we have a bunch of studies showing that the people who mistrust vaccines, doctors, medical advice, they are much more likely to overestimate their own knowledge about medicine and science. Like, these are people who think they know better. So, I mean, it sounds to me like you're saying, look, have some empathy. We won't be able to convince them to get vaccines unless we treat them like humans who have complicated and nuanced motivations. Is that accurate? Is that close to what you're saying to me?
Yeah. I mean, I think, look, I'm going to draw a parallel here because I think this is a similar audience, and it gives you kind of a window into my own research progression from studying evangelical Christianity to then vaccine skepticism, is that I think that there are ways in which popular media, in broad strokes, distills entire groups of people and entire kind of ways of believing and frameworks as being distasteful or being despicable even, and being completely irrational. And one of my jobs as an anthropologist, and, you know, this is the kind of work that anthropologists do all over the world, is not to say that this is right or wrong. I'm a cultural observer, right? I'm not saying, with evangelical Christianity, I always say it's not an ontological question. I'm not saying, yes, this is a right system of belief or this is a wrong system of belief, but rather, how is it something that makes sense to so many people? That's my job. And so that's what I would say here, is that my job is not to say that, that this entirely makes sense or this is a right way of believing, but rather if we dig a little bit and we try to learn from the people who are actually experiencing and making these decisions, then perhaps we can understand it better and maybe understand our own society and the problems that face us and the kinds of divisions and divisiveness that we have with some potentially positive ways of moving the needle, because right now we don't really see those in terms of this. And so if our current way of talking about it has not been helpful and has in some ways kind of further polarized, then is there a way that maybe bringing a different landscape of understanding or attention to a different horizon or part of the problem might help us further things?
So we have to take another break, but there's still more to say, so stay with us. I'm Celeste Headley. You're listening to Hear Me Out, a podcast from Slate, and we will return.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C., on Tuesday, May the 14th, my colleague Mark Joseph Stern and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title the Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
Good to have you back. This is Hear Me Out, a podcast from Slate. I'm Celeste Headley, and we're talking about the vaccine hesitant. And Johanna Richland says we should not vilify them. So we only have a few minutes left here, Johanna, and I have to get to the point of why does it matter? And I say that not because they're human beings and we should all try to make connections and respect one another as human beings, regardless of what their opinions are. But from a practical standpoint, if you don't believe that red lights are fair, maybe you think that you're a better driver than anybody, you know better than the urban planners, and you shouldn't have to stop at a red light. It doesn't matter, right? Like, you have to keep you're not going to keep people safe if you keep running through red lights. It causes a lot of deaths. And so we make laws and says, it doesn't matter. Your feelings don't matter here. This is the rule because we know there is an answer to whether vaccines are safe or not. And the answer is they are. So we're going to make this law. So understanding that your whole job is to study the whys and motivations, from a practical standpoint, why should it matter to me?
I think that's a good question. I mean, I think that if we are interested in building bridges and living in a world where perhaps there's less intense polarization and inability to talk across different demographics and across different lines or to people that we think we have complete inability to understand, or they have a complete inability to understand us, if that's an important value or an important way to conceive of a potential future that has more opening in it and more bridges, then I would say for all of us, it's important to speak from a place of empathy and try to understand, you know, if it's not just the characterizations that we see in the news, or if it's not just the worst case scenario that we think of when we think of people asserting certain viewpoints, then how is it that they came to those viewpoints? And again, you know, I think vaccine skepticism is in the news, especially right now, because of the political dimensions and how it's become mapped on to a very, you know, right wing, far right kind of belief system. But prior to that, many, many people, prior to the politicization, many people on the right had their children vaccinated, you know, before COVID, and didn't start writing off vaccines until more recently. And so this isn't a new problem. People have always kind of projected their fears and anxieties onto vaccines, onto phobias about the medical system and about healthcare and what could be trusted. And so it's not just this moment where it's important. It's important as a broader kind of framework for understanding where these feelings come from and how people apply these feelings in terms of their day-to-day decision-making, whether that's medical care or whether that's political decisions, that there's something to be learned by delving into these issues.
Yes. I mean, that. Look, you're never going to get pushback from me on treating people with empathy and with basic respect, regardless of your agreement. But I mean, I got to say, I get pretty impatient at this point with people who have been, who have had a lot of compassionate conversation, who have seen celebrities come out and give these patient, loving conversations about why vaccines are important. They've had people, leaders in the disabled community, say, listen, this is about saving lives. And yet people will push all that aside because Donald Trump is making them feel vaccine hesitant, or whoever their right-wing leader is saying, don't believe any of that stuff. They're all wrong. They're all lying to you because of whatever conspiracy theory, or they're a pawn of Joe Biden or whatever it may be. I don't mean to downplay people's political beliefs. All I'm saying is that they will take all of the messages from experts, from public figures, and toss it in the garbage because of what a politician is saying. That's what's happening today.
And I think that that's an important data point, which is that people who feel strongly that they don't trust are not going to be convinced. They're not going to be convinced by reasoning. They're not going to be convinced by information. That's partly why I think public health messaging often falls really flat for these groups, because they can't be convinced. It's not about convincing. So if convincing doesn't work, and if it's not about information, then it's about the level of feeling and affect. And that's a whole different kind of conversation and terrain. That's about a question of feeling and trust and affect and emotion. And that's partly why it's such a dicey and difficult subject matter. And as you also rightly demonstrate, it's not just the people who feel strongly about not wanting to get vaccines or not trusting the system, but it's people feeling really, really strongly that people who don't do that are causing inordinate harm and are being very, very selfish. And so if those are the two kind of polarized sides of the debate, it doesn't seem like there's much place to go, right? But if there's a way of trying to shift the kinds of conversations that we're having, I mean, you said just a little while ago, all Americans, we all have reasons to distrust healthcare, right? We can all understand that. If that's a jumping off point, then maybe there's a way to start seeing, well, where do people go off the tracks, right? Where is it that you go from this data point to that data point to then jumping all the way to this position that becomes cemented and entrenched that you have a very difficult time moving from? And so I think that's just something to consider. I'll also say that I think it's also really important to know that people who feel suspicious of vaccines or medicine are not just on the right by any means. They're all over the political spectrum, which makes a third party candidate very, very, for many people, very compelling and popular. And so
you mean Robert Kennedy?
Yeah, exactly. And so it's, again, this isn't just a question of far-right extremism and Trumpism, but it's actually something that is much more deeply embedded in U.S. society and history and was kind of ignited. You know, there was a match blown onto it during COVID-19 that has burst it to the fore and made it a real something really to contend with, which I think, again, is another reason why we ought to take some time to understand more nuance surrounding the issue.
I mean, that's fair enough. It's a fair point. Either way, I really appreciate you coming onto the show to talk about it because it's a really important issue.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for taking the time to chat.
Listen, nothing gets more email than hot takes on vaccines. I know you have thoughts about this, and I also know I want to hear them. So email us. Let us know what you think about the vaccine hesitant. Maybe you're one of them. Maybe you're angry at them. Maybe whatever your point of view is, we want to hear it. It's hearmeout@slate.com. And honestly, we love hearing your thoughts, whether you agree with our guests or you don't. Last week, we spoke with Richard Friedman about his idea that therapy should not be something we do all the time. We got some very thoughtful email from you about that conversation. So before we go, we wanted to share a note we got from Pam. Pam wrote this: "Just a quick weigh-in, the program on therapy was absolutely ridiculous. Yes, more people are feeling comfortable about talking about the fact that they have a therapist. Most people do come into the world with confusion because we're asked to make sense of the world at a very young age. Unpacking that and putting a new strategy in place is no easy feat. Sadly, there's still an incredible resistance from everyday people who are causing themselves and others damage because they won't take a look inside. I fear the message your guest might be sending." You know, Pam, that was the bulk of my pushback on our guest as well, the fear that people would take what he was saying as a reason not to get therapy. So thank you for sending that in. And for the rest of you, please send in your thoughts as well, because we do want to hear from you. Our email address is hearmeout@slate.com. Keep your emails coming. Hear Me Out is a podcast from Slate. The show is produced by Maura Curry. Ben Richmond is the Senior Director of Podcast Operations. And Alicia Montgomery is the VP of Slate Audio. I'm your host, Celeste Headley. Until next time, speak your mind, but keep it open.